Thanks for listening to the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast. Today on the pod, missed call. Why can't our 911 system keep up with emergency calls? Plus, does Vancouver's first baby of 2023 reopen the conversation surrounding birth tourism? And New Year, same problems. The Yale Town Clothing Boutique suffers two break-ins in two nights. When does this end? That's all next on the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast. Let's focus on the issue of the moment, that being e-com. Now, we know it is our 911 service, where we call them for emergencies, for police, fire, or medical emergencies. Well, recently, the mayor of Delta, in his capacity as police board chair, sent a letter to the province demanding immediate action to address problems plaguing BC's 911 communications center. Now, George Harvey says he was concerned that the e-com office has not been living up to the contract when it comes to standards for answering both emergency and non-emergency calls. Joining us now is Delta's mayor. He's also the police board chair and, of course, Metro Vancouver board chair as well. Your worship, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So let's talk specifically about the letter at this point. George, what prompted you to send this letter specifically? Was there an incident or a variety of incidents that convinced you that you needed to do this?
I signed a letter on behalf of the Delta Police Board. We've been discussing this matter with their police chief and involved staff for over a year. And it was final frustration by the board that it was decided to send a letter. We didn't want to send a letter unnecessarily, but we were at our wit's end, if I could use those terms, and to bring it to their attention that we cannot have this going on much longer. I just want to say, first of all, this is nothing about the dedicated working staff they have there. I know a number of the individuals, they work extremely hard in very, very tough situations, but they are just not being supported. They are very understaffed, they're working too much overtime, terrible stress. But again, it's not about the workers there. I need to do something in my position as a politician to try to help them.
Mm-hmm. Now, was it 40% of Delta residents trying to reach police for, I guess it would be non-emergency lines, where they were routed through BC's e-com dispatch center, to my understanding, and they were abandoned?
Yes. So in 2022, the first 6 months, the statistics we received as a board members was that 40% of the Delta residents trying to reach police non-emergency lines actually had their calls abandoned. And as many people know, Delta Police, the department itself, was formed in 1888. The foundation of policing in Delta has been for many, many decades about no call too small. So this actually erodes our ability to continue no call too small. And one of the reasons we're one of the safest police departments and police communities in Canada is because of the no-to-call policy. And I'm very worried that we're going to lose that and it's going to get worse.
We were talking about the 40%, which is non-emergency calls. Were you seeing even a drop-off for emergency calls?
Yes, we know that our emergency calls have been abandoned also. The lead times for addressing those calls has increased to an unacceptable level. But what also bothers me is, as mayor and chair of the police board, but mostly as mayor, I'm responsible for ensuring that the taxpayers in Delta, the fiscal responsibility for our expenditures. We are not receiving the outcomes of the contract we have with Econ. We're paying for what we were receiving many years ago, but the call service is not meeting those standards. And that bothers me because we shouldn't be paying for something that we're not getting under contract.
What is causing this in your mind? Was it COVID related, or is there something deeper and structural?
Well, I think it's much deeper. I just reviewed just a few days ago. It was a bulletin that the Econ put out about 20 years of public safety service in BC, starting in 1999 to 2019. And I was around in 1999 on a committee that was forming Econ. So in 1999, Econ dispatched for 8 agencies. Today, they are now providing dispatch services for 73 police and fire agencies. So if you go back to looking at the statistics, in 1999, there were 177 employees serving 8 agencies, an average of 22 employees per agency. In 2019, 20 years later, there were 650 staff serving 73 police and fire agencies, an average of 9 staff per agency. So to me, it's just that it's grown far too much, and we need to have the province accept a review to see how we can do a better management of 911, not just in Delta, not just in Metro Vancouver, but throughout the province.
besides your letter, what else can you do as mayor? I mean, would you set up your own system if this system continues to deteriorate in your mind?
Yes, we have to look at options. We can't have a no call too small actually abandoned because of econ. So we are, through the police board and our police chief and staff are looking at other options to address with the police board. But as mayor, I will be looking at my role in Metro Vancouver chair. I'm going to be asking the chair of the mayor's committee in Metro Vancouver, which is Mayor Brenda Locke from Surrey. I'm going to ask her to, in one of her meetings, which is coming up very shortly, to have this as an agenda item. And I will be meeting and setting up a meeting with other mayors that have independent police departments in Metro Vancouver to discuss this issue and other issues. But as chair of the police board in Delta and as Metro chair, I need to ensure that we're moving this subject forward to the province with urgency.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just by the numbers that you gave me earlier in regards to, I think it was 650 employees, dealing with at ECOM, dealing with 72 different police and fire agencies compared to what was there before, you would need a significant amount of new people, new hires, and ultimately a much bigger budget to meet the, per capita coverage that you had when ECOM first launched.
Well, it's interesting about the growth of this, of ECOM for BC. Again, it was never envisioned to cover, the whole of BC. It was only envisioned to cover Metro Vancouver. But you can see how much it's grown. And actually, how do you get all that staff complement in today's world by having one location? That's ECOM's location right now is an impediment to attracting staff because of where it is and how do you get there. So we need to look at some options now. But again, it is just much too big an operation to provide effective services.
I'm just spitballing here, but do you think if you were to create a new system today, maybe you would have an ECOM system based, let's say, in the interior some way, let's say Kelowna, perhaps one for the island and then one for Metro Vancouver. Would that be something that perhaps maybe much more palatable, maybe work structurally for our population and our geography here in British Columbia?
Yes, I think that's the concept that I would like to talk with my fellow mayors about, also hopefully with the province on board of looking at options. We've always envisioned there would be perhaps a second ECOM for Metro Vancouver, south of the Fraser, for example. But those are things that we need to look at now, because right now, the only words I can say is that it's broken.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mayor Harvey, I know you have a very busy day beyond being mayor of Delta. You've got the Metro Board responsibilities as well. I really appreciate you taking some time for our audience today. Thank you so much for this chat with us in regards to this very, very important issue. Thanks so much.
Thank you, and please stay in touch.
Go to any Starbucks in the morning or a McDonald's or a Tim Hortons. We love our coffee here. In Canada, especially here in the Lower Mainland, and there is a change coming for those who have reward cards with Starbucks and Tim Hortons specifically. Our resident coffeeholic, Bianca Rego, now joins us. Hello, Bianca.
Hello, Jazz. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Now, it's fair to say you love your coffee?
I do love my coffee, and I love it to be made very specifically.
You're one of those people.
I'm one of those people, and I hate being one of those people, but I just can't help it.
Is it a health thing? Like you need something specific? Like,
no.
Are you one of those, you don't like regular milk, you have to have a certain type of...
I drink oat milk or almond milk. And I used to drink just black coffee, but it just wasn't as satisfying as a handcrafted beverage. Like a vanilla latte, one would say.
Okay. Well, we'll go through your coffee habits in a few minutes, because let's let's talk about the specifics in regards to the reward programs. We all love reward programs. We have them for flying. We have them for coffee. Now, Starbucks and Tim Hortons are changing their program.
They are changing their program, and they are making it so they are raising the reward program by 50 points. So currently, if you want to get a free just black brewed coffee, it's 50 stars, Starbucks stars, to get that for free. They're upping that to 100. And to get a free handcrafted beverage, it's usually 150 stars, but they're upping that to 200. And now if you want to get like a free wrap or a sandwich, rather than being 200 stars, it is going to be 250. And so each star you get, it's per every dollar you spend. Mm. Unless you have a preloaded Starbucks card, then you get 2 stars per every dollar you spend.
Now, those cards, when you think about them, whether it be Starbucks or any reward program, let's say you put $20 on those cards, $50, you're basically giving the company money and they put it in a bank account.
Mm-hmm.
And they make interest off that until you decide to use some of that money.
Precisely.
So they love these reward programs because they can actually make money off of them while you're sort of, you know, using those dollars, but taking your time using those dollars.
Exactly. And also, speaking of those reward programs, what I find funny is that it prompts you when you're ordering a coffee to preload a card. And rather than just buying it with your Visa, and those cards, you're unable to split the difference of the cost. If, let's say, my coffee's $9 and I have $4 left on my preloaded Starbucks card, I can't put $4 on my Visa and $4 on my Starbucks card. So I have like 5 different Starbucks cards that just have $4 in them that I am unable to use. So it's just free money for them. If you put it all together, I could get like 3 days worth of coffee.
Now, I was just looking at social media as you were speaking as well. Like, here's one individual who basically says to earn one free cup of coffee using a prepaid Starbucks card, you have to buy 17 cups, which he says, look, this is basically doubling what's going to be required in regards to get that one free cup of coffee. That's a lot of money, $17 or 17 cups of coffee. You got to spend quite a bit just to get that one free cup of coffee.
And
right?
When you think about it, like a free cup of coffee isn't that much to them. I was looking up how much espresso, bags of espresso cost at Starbucks, and it's only about like $18. So let's say you're getting 3 shots of espresso. It costs them probably like 50 cents with some, like a little amount of milk. The cost to them is like 75 cents and you're paying like $10 for it, which is insane.
So you said you used to drink black coffee, but now it's a bit more, the order's a little longer now, right?
It is much longer because I realize that when I add syrup to my coffee, I get an extra little kick of energy. So I started doing that.
So I'm the barista. Hello, Bianca. Welcome to Starbucks. Can I take your order? Before I misspell your name on your cup, what would you like to have? So what would your order be?
My order would be a grande toasted vanilla oat milk latte with 4 shots of espresso. And you wonder why I'm so hyper in the morning. Now you know.
What does it cost?
It costs $8.82.
$8.82?
$8.82 for me not to be a nightmare in the morning, yes.
How, and so you have that one cup of coffee per day at Starbucks?
Yes. So I also do have an espresso that I do need to fill up, and that would significantly cut down my costs, but it's always such a long lineup to get the pods for it. So as of right now, yes, I am drinking one of those a day.
So I'm just going to do the math here on my phone.
Please don't.
So 365 days in the year times $9, drum roll, $3,285, $3,200 in coffee. And that's why, I'm not saying it's fair, boomers always say, you know, the reason you millennials never save any money is because
it's the Starbucks coffee and the avocados and the price of avocados. I'll tell you that for free.
Oh, you know what? I'm just going to do some more math here. Let's say you bought 35,000 cups of coffee.
Okay, probably
times
have.
$9. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, that's $315,000. I know that's a huge number. That's probably half a condo. That's a huge down payment on a condo in Olympic Village. I'm just saying that, and this is you, like I buy sometimes. I don't buy as much as you, that's for sure. And I just get a regular coffee. I'm just that kind of guy. But when you look at these cards, these reward cards, it's amazing. They've attracted us all. We all love the free cup of coffee or the free trip. Remember Air Canada also had their Aeroplan card. But this is about 7-8 years ago. And then they said, look, you got to start using some of this stuff and then we're going to make it tougher for you. And it comes down to, it sits as a liability on their books.
How so?
Well, because if you owe somebody, let's say, I'm talking about Air Canada here, if all of us are making points and not using them, and somewhere along the way, that sits as a liability on their books, right?
Okay.
And they wanted to compel you to start using them, and then they start the new system, which is going to be a little tougher for you to get those points. The core problem is these cards or anything free. We love free. So whether it's free miles or free coffee, we love this stuff so much. It gets so popular that it doesn't work for them. So hence, we're going to make it a little tougher for you to get that free cup of coffee, right?
Sneaky.
It is, if you think about it. Well, that one individual who tweeted out, he says to earn one free cup of coffee using a prepaid card, you have to buy 17 cups. Using cash or linked credit card, you have to buy 34 cups. So it kind of gives you a sense of what's happening. It's partially, I think it is a bit of a liability. Partially, I just think it's popular. All these cards become so popular, too popular, that then the company wakes up going, wait a minute here, this is
too much. It's costing them too much. And also, it's just the convenience about having buying it online, because you don't need to wait in line, and then it sucks you in, and then just the free coffee is an added perk.
I know. Look, we just had a whole conversation on coffee. Typical Vancouver, I'd say.
Typical us, typical media.
But I think you're going to have to drink some of that free coffee we have here at work.
Yeah, I'm trying.
We got two places. They're not bad, you know, but $3,285. That's like two all-inclusive trips to Mexico. I'm just saying.
You know what?
I sound like a dad.
I will try it. You know, I will try it, and we'll see how the week goes, and I'll update you on that afterwards.
We should probably have you back here on Friday.
How do you feel? How's your energy level?
Exactly. We should bring you on without coffee and see how it goes.
Oh, no.
There you go. All right, Bianca, thank you.
Thank you, Jazz.
Let's talk a little bit about birth tourism for a moment. Well, this morning I was checking out the website for Vancouver is Awesome. And of course, they had a story on the first baby born in Vancouver in 2023. It was a baby girl. What I found interesting in the article, I read that the parents were from Egypt. In fact, they're Egyptian citizens. In fact, they plan to move back to Egypt. In the article, they stated that they carefully considered the place for their child's birth. And after doing their research, the decision came down to the U.S. or Canada. So they chose Canada because it's a wonderful country. And so the child born here in Vancouver, the first child born in 2023, is granted automatic citizenship. Now, Canadian citizenship is typically obtained by childbirth in Canada on the principle of jus soli. Now, jus soli is a Latin phrase for the right of soil. It's commonly used to refer to birthright citizenship, the right of anyone born in the territory of a country to nationality or citizenship of that country. Now, unfortunately, the principle is slowly becoming a thing of the past. Now, some countries have abolished it completely, like India. Many other countries, including developed nations like Australia, France, Germany, Ireland, New Zealand, Spain, and the UK, have introduced restrictions to jus soli, mostly requiring at least one parent to have citizenship of that country. Now, only a limited number of the world's 195 countries grant citizenship at birth to the children of foreign nationals. No European country grants automatic citizenship based on jus soli. Canada is actually one of the fewer than three dozen countries that follow the practice of citizenship based on birthright. Now, the challenge, of course, with all this is we've talked for a significant period of time about the issue of birth tourism. And when I read this article today, that's what it reminded me of. That's what it looked like. And I just want to say that the parents themselves have done nothing illegal. This is completely legal. But I found it interesting that we've been talking about birth tourism, and today, or at least this week, the first child born in Vancouver in 2023 appears to be a child born based on the issue of birth tourism. Now, one individual who has covered the issue significantly is Graham Wood. He's an investigative reporter for Glacier Media, and he joins us now. Good afternoon, Graham. Oh, hello, Graham. Would we have you? Oh,
hi, Jazz.
There you go. There you go. I'm doing very well. Thank you for joining us. You and I, you know, you've been covering this story for a long time. I've been following it very closely as well. And as I was saying, you know, the story itself today, like I said, the parents haven't done anything illegal. This is completely illegal. But certainly on the surface of it, when you look at it, this is birth tourism, is it not?
Yeah, this is absolutely a case of birth tourism. You know, it's a loaded word, I guess, for some people, but this is absolutely a case of purposefully coming over to Canada, picking your location and paying to give birth, paying for accommodations, and ultimately waiting to get that coveted passport and to return back to Egypt.
You've covered this story extensively. Walk me through pre-COVID. What were the numbers looking like here in Vancouver when it comes to the issue of birth tourism?
pre-COVID, we were BC was upwards of 900 births per year in 2019. About just over 520 were occurring at Richmond Hospital, and nationwide, the estimates are about 5,000. And there's different ways of counting them, but we could say about 5,000 per year, a little under 1.5% of all births in Canada.
So walk me through this. As I said, the couple haven't done anything wrong. Based on law, it's absolutely legal what they did. The child does get citizenship. But to go through this process, foreign nationals, first of all, would have to stay somewhere. So there's the issue of accommodations. You can't just walk into a Canadian or BC hospital and just say, you know, we're going to give birth here. You actually have to have a GP. So you would have to find a GP too, right?
Yeah. So we talked this morning about this issue, and I was able to get a bit of background from some doctors I know. And what you do is you come over here and you either can stay with family. Maybe you have family here, maybe you don't. So in that case, there's some baby house operators, maternity houses, people who provide conduct a business for this. But the other thing is you need a GP a pediatrician, and they need to deliver the baby, and so you have to pay these doctors in through the private system. And from what I can gather, it will cost about $5,000, depending on the type of birth. So you have, you know, up to 10 doctor visits in the 2 months leading up to the birth. And then it's about $2,500 for a C-section delivery, which is probably the most common course of birth for non-residents. Once you've obtained your doctor, who's, you know, likely happy to have that extra income, they'll register you at a hospital that provides birth. So Richmond Hospital, Lionsgate Hospital. We were seeing a bit of an uptick before COVID in Surrey. And at that point, you have to pay anywhere from $10,000 to $13,000 to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And after that, you can head home. You probably head back to your accommodations. It could be paid. It could be a simple Airbnb. It could be one of these baby houses. And then, you know, it takes about 6 weeks, according to these people from Egypt, to get all the documents and paperwork and essentially get your passport.
And this child is then a Canadian citizen. Has there been any conversation in a meaningful way? Because ultimately, immigration is a federal issue. Healthcare is provincial. Has there been any conversation about ending this practice in Canada? Because I think whether you're left wing or right wing, you know, I think most Canadians, reasonable people, would say there's something fundamentally wrong with foreign nationals coming to this country. Yes, paying for the service, like they haven't broken any rules, and the child automatically gets Canadian citizenship. Has there been any talk about changing these rules, these laws federally?
Yeah, before COVID hit, there was talk of a federal study. There hasn't been any published work on this yet. They're trying to understand the issue. There's the critics of the critics, I suppose, would say that this isn't that big of an issue, that the legislative changes would be, taking a hammer to a mole, or, you know, taking a sledgehammer to a very mouse or what have you. Mm-hmm. But there hasn't, you know, since COVID hit, there hasn't been any word from the federal government on this. It was sort of, it was brushed aside. The numbers have gone down drastically due to the travel restrictions. But it appears to be that we're jumping back onto the carousel. So it will be interesting to see if this will be an issue.
Have there any lawsuits, any issues of the medical practice? I think we have a good healthcare system. It is challenged, of course. Have there been any medical complications where foreign nationals do come in here with children here?
Yeah, just last month there was there's a lawsuit that's being launched against the two two most popular pediatricians who deliver not to non-residents. That's before the courts now. There's the the parents of a Chinese couple. They had some complications. Unfortunately, their son has suffered some life-altering injuries, and they're suing the hospital, the public hospital, as well as the pediatricians who were hired. And I'm not too sure what the implications are for those pediatricians if they have insurance coverage through the Canadian Medical Association.
I'm curious. Graham, I'm curious. Like, you know, perhaps we don't need a full change of the law, but even a simple change, one would argue, is if you come to this country, I'm assuming on a tourist visa. There's no visa to say I'm coming to Canada to have a baby. If they're probably coming on a tourist visa. Could we not make citizenship null and void because you came in based on a tourist visa? As I said, some European countries say, look, at least one of the parents has to be a citizen before that child is given citizenship if they're born here. But in the case of foreign nationals coming to this country, couldn't we just say, wait a minute, you're both here on tourist visas. That's not a tourist thing to do. Your child is not going to get citizenship in this country.
Yeah, I think it just comes down to political will, whether or not the politicians and the bureaucrats want to put in the effort here. There's really no other explanation as to why, you know, if they're not going to do it, they're not going to do it. It doesn't appear that the Liberal government wanted to do it. They said that they were studying it. There's been no movement on that. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a bureaucrat. I don't understand what the laws would be in terms of legislation, if that would be too onerous, the paperwork or what have you. So it really comes down to weighing the values that you put on citizenship, that we, the public, do, versus the actual time and effort that you have, that you would have put in to close up those loopholes. Like, maybe you shouldn't have citizenship based on your parents being international students or just simply simply tourists.
Graham, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jazz. Take care.
2022 is a busy year when it comes to civic politics. New mayors for two of our biggest municipalities, Vancouver and Surrey, as well as a new chair for the Metro Vancouver Board. In this case, George Harvey was the mayor of Delta. He was on the show, of course, at 3 o'clock today. Winning elections, of course, is one thing. Governing is another. Lots of issues to be debated and discussed this year. I'm sure we'll be covering a lot of it. Joining us now to talk about civic politics here in the Lower Mainland is Francis Buehler, who's a political contributor for the Globe and Mail. Francis, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Jazz. Always great to be here.
Happy New Year to you. I haven't talked to you in a little while, and I thought it was time to catch up and get a sense of what we will be looking at when it comes to issues here in the Lower Mainland. Let's start with Vancouver for a second. I know it's very early days in regards to Ken Sim and his administration's sort of running the city today. They have a majority across from park board to school board and city hall. What do you foresee in regards to the issues that are going to be front and center for Mr. Sim and his slate?
Well, the issues that will be front and center are the ones that he promised to handle in a better way than the last council. So that means dealing with the whole public disorder, homelessness, you know, random vandalism, petty crime. And you know, I'm not saying that it's the same group of people with everything. That would be wrong. But there is a sense of people, particularly in certain areas of the city, that, you know, things are fraying, and they promised to do. That was their number one priority, hiring 100 extra police officers, 100 extra psychiatric nurses to work with those police officers on the CAR 87 model. So that is going to be the big push, and figuring out how to do it, because that is a big budget hit. And they, the number two issues are going to be the budget, which they're going to be talking about all through January and maybe even February, depending on how things go. So, you know, that's really the big issue. And it covers so many things. It's like, you know, Chinatown revitalization, because in Chinatown, they feel that they have been very impacted by the public disorder. But it's a particular area that needs, you know, can't have the same kind of solutions as maybe, you know, Kerrisdale or Kitsilano or something like that. So really big, and they didn't promise easy solutions. They didn't say we're going to clear off Hastings by, you know, December, the way the NPA did, and so on. And these are super complex problems, mm-hmm. like every major city in North America, and particularly cities on the West Coast, are dealing with this. And I have to say, I see no one succeeding.
Mm-hmm. I guess that brings me to the second question. I mean, is it too big for any government, especially a municipal government, to be able to successfully tackle this when you look at the issue of petty crime, when you look at the issue of mental health and addiction? I mean, how much of a role do you, how much of an impact do you think a municipal government can actually have on this issue?
I mean, they can. They can't pay for it all. There's no way. You know, every level of government has to get involved in this. But a municipality can make a big difference by having a mayor and a council who are very vocal, who are strong leaders, who identify a goal and drive towards it and make sure everyone's kind of herded and you know, going in the same direction. They can't solve it by themselves. There's no way, but they can lead the way. And, you know, Vancouver's lucky. There's a sympathetic NDP government in power. There's a sympathetic Liberal government in power. Both of and both of those levels are aware that there's a kind of concern about the way cities are fraying across the country, and the level of homelessness and the level of, like, what seems to be social dysfunction and you know, people who need help not getting it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this council, in its early days, it's up for the task here? And what I mean by that is you have some experience there, but you see a lot of newbies there, whether it be a school board, whether it be a park board, whether it be a city hall as well. I know it's very early days. How would you describe so far from what you've seen in their ability to deal with the challenges there that are there before them?
I mean, I think they're in a better position in some ways than some other councils that I've seen sweep into power, like, you know, Cope in 2002, where you ended up with a pretty completely brand new council and with a mayor who was somewhat at odds with, you know, some of the values of the traditional Cope party. So in this case, there's three experienced councillors, Sarah Kirby-Young, Lisa Dominato, and Rebecca Bly, who understand a bit better how the, you know, city functions than newbies. I mean, they've only been long-term each, so they don't know it inside out the way, you know, some long-term councillors I've known might. But, you know, this is not a council that's totally at sea, and I expect those three to really play a very strong role because they do understand what the city a little bit, and they understand what the city can and can't do. So they're not as bad off as some. I'd say the park board is in way more trouble because it is total newbies, total flip around from, you know, who was in charge the past 4 years, and some really difficult problems to handle with a board where people are paid like $20,000 a year to sit through endless meetings trying to solve massive social problems, and the staff of the park board as opposed to the staff of the whole city.
What are the challenges? I'm curious with park board. Park board sometimes gets too much criticism, but I'm very curious. I know before Christmas break we were talking a lot about the bike lane. That would be one issue that can be very high volume, but not as controversial as some people may think. What are the sort of the issues do you think that are before them that they're going to have challenges with?
Well, again, it's the social disorder. I mean, the park board's main job has turned into like trying to keep homeless camps from getting out of control, and there is a very large one at Crab Park. And anyone who lives in Vancouver, particularly on the east side, knows that there are tents popping up in various parks. And you know, I can't imagine the person power that the park board is having to expend just to try to keep things status quo and make sure the parks don't get closed off to regular citizens because they've essentially turned into homeless camps. So that is their big issue. And then, everything flows from that. Like there's a lot of complaints about the lack of maintenance in the parks. But again, they're struggling with like a massive problem that normally a parks department, you know, in the past, the parks department hasn't had to expend so much energy on it, which is dealing with the fallout from homelessness, social disorder and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, we are speaking to Frances Beulah, political contributor for the Globe and Mail. She follows civic politics here in the Lower Mainland. We always love having her on to get a sense of what's many of our major city councils are working on. And we spent a lot of time talking about Vancouver. Let's focus a little bit on Surrey. Francis, we are expecting a decision from the Solicitor General very soon in regards to the entire Surrey RCMP versus Surrey Police Service conversation. What are your thoughts just overall just seeing Surrey and sort of the high profile debates and conversations they've been having in that community over the last 2 or 3 years? What do you think the year looks like when it comes to Brenda Locke and what she hopes to accomplish there?
Well, I mean, it will really depend on the Solicitor General's decision. If he says, if Mike Farnworth says, no, we've gone too far down this road, and the province itself is thinking of having an independent police force rather than the RCMP, so we might as well get going here. That was the big thing that she campaigned on. It was her one issue that differentiated her from other candidates who came close, because Gordie Hogue had also challenged Doug McCallum, but he hadn't promised to completely reverse the Surrey police decision. So that's going to be a very big deal for her, how that decision goes. If they agree with her and keep the RCMP, she's vindicated, she's won on the big issue she campaigned on. If not, it's going to be a tough thing to recover from, and they'll have to figure out, like, how do they work with that decision.
You raise a very good point there that, you know, it's a tough decision. It's not an easy decision for Mike Farnworth. There's one side that say, well, do the easiest thing and go back to the RCMP. That's what Brenda Locke ran on, although she only won by about 900 votes or so. But one could easily argue, as you've said, we are probably eventually going to get to a BC police force for the Lower Mainland in some capacity. Does that get us a little bit closer? And does that make the decision a little bit easier over the next few years if we go with a Surrey Police Service? So I don't think it's as black and white as some people think. Now, one of the other issues is Surrey. And through the whole region is just growth. We heard from the federal government that by 2025, we should be welcoming 500,000 new Canadians per year. As I've said many times on this show, I remember the 1990s when we used to debate 225,000 immigrants, if that was too much. Brenda Locke was on this show a few weeks ago, and she reminded me that Surrey now grows by about 1,500 residents per month, new residents every month, every 30 days. The region itself, how do you think it can cope, is there a way to have a coherent housing policy, do you think, where we can finally start building in a coherent way? Some cities do it better than others. Vancouver would be better than others and vice versa. How do you think what Mr. Eby wants to do moving forward in regards to housing will sort of play out for the region?
Well, that's going to be another really fascinating issue because he's signaled very, very clearly that he expects all municipalities to be taking on their share of new housing. And there's a new housing act that is specifically focuses on that. So, places like Vancouver, Surrey, Coquitlam, Richmond, I would say Burnaby, they don't have to worry too much because they've been building a lot. Like I did a look at what those cities have said they need and what they're building. And for the most part, they're exceeding their targets. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the ones that haven't exceeded their targets, the sort of the District of North Vancouver, West Vancouver, Port Moody, maybe, White Rock, Port Coquitlam, places like that, whether there'll be a bit more pressure. You raise a good point. There isn't to my knowledge, there hasn't been a really good public discussion among the mayors about how are we going to all do our part here. I certainly get the impression from the mayors, they talk about it privately. You know, Richard Stewart, you know, sort of jabs some of his colleagues sometimes about, you know, why don't you do a bit more?
Yes.
But they haven't really had a big public discussion about how are we all going to reach a regional goal to absorb these people. Like, people have been willing to sort of let the heavy hitters take on a lot of the load and sit back and kind of go, well, everyone wants to move to Vancouver anyway, so we don't have to do anything. So that could be an interesting discussion. And especially, you mentioned George Harvey,
yeah,
who's going to be the chair of Metro Vancouver. Well, Metro Vancouver has a new plan, a new 30-year plan, and part of it involves housing targets. That could be the occasion for that, because that needs to get passed, and he's going to have to be outselling that plan to different parts of the region. So I think we're going to see some interesting conversations at various councils about, are we doing enough, or we don't care if we're not doing enough. They can all go, you know, whatever. Everyone can take a flying leap. We're happy the way we are.
Yeah.
So that could be an interesting discussion over the next 4 years, for sure.
I think you're absolutely right. There are some suburbs who prefer to remain sleepy, and I think they're going to have to be coaxed a little bit. So it'll be very interesting how that all transpires. Frances, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, and I'm looking forward to 2023, and I'm sure we're both going to be surprised at a few points.
Well, House Republicans flailed through a second day of multiple balloting, unable to elect their leader, Kevin McCarthy, as House Speaker, or come up with a new strategy than the political chaos that has tarnished the start of their new majority. Now, for a fourth, fifth, and sixth time, Republicans tried to vote McCarthy into the top job as the House plunged deeper into disarray. Well, our next guest is following this. All of this as it transpires in real time. Reggie Cicchini is Global News Washington correspondent. Reggie, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Jess.
I know it's late into the evening there now in Washington. What's your sense of how everything transpired today?
Well, what transpired today could potentially transpire tonight. And I say that only because there is a vote that is underway right now and will wrap up in just the next couple of minutes. Republicans were trying to adjourn for the night so that they could continue on with themselves and then possibly bring this to a vote tomorrow. But as of right now, it looks like they don't have the votes to do that. And this could become a situation where voting goes on for the next several hours because Democrats are not willing to give Republicans any kind of leeway here. So what that builds upon is the three failed rounds of voting that occurred in the House over the course of the afternoon. Republicans not lining up behind leader Kevin McCarthy. McCarthy himself refusing to bow out. And what we have is a House that is in disarray, but also a House that is non-functional.
Is there a way out of this? I mean, at this point, from what you're explaining to me, we could vote as many times as we want. No one seems to be budging here.
Precisely. I mean, this is beating a political dead horse. On the first round of voting yesterday, Kevin McCarthy lost by 19 or 20. And on the sixth round of voting today, he lost by 20, albeit to a different challenger who was put forth by the so-called Republican rebels who will not line up behind McCarthy. And Representative Matt Gaetz out of Florida kind of held a bit of a scrum in the halls of the Capitol not long ago. And he was flat out asked, what is it going to take for you to potentially move this forward? And the line was for Kevin McCarthy to drop out of the race. McCarthy's not going to do that. He believes he can still figure out a way to get the victory. This just acts as a bit of political tarnish now on the legacy that kind of led Kevin McCarthy to where he is and whatever may come after this.
What do these 20 conservative holdouts want?
They want change in the House of Representatives. These are some anti-establishment members of Congress. And I think, you know, beyond that, it's important to remember that some of these candidates are from ruby red Donald Trump areas around the United States that have been backed by Donald Trump. But Trump himself is also backing Kevin McCarthy. So there's a lot of kind of political optics at play here. But ultimately, they want more power. They do not want the House of Representatives to be a top-down structure. They want to weaken the chair so that members of Congress, rank and file members within the Republican Party, get a bigger say when it comes to the investigations or the agenda that's going to come forward. And Kevin McCarthy has been willing to bend on some of that, but not all of that. And that is now a sticking point.
Correct me if I'm wrong. This is the first time in 100 years that a nominee for House Speaker hasn't been able to take the gavel in the first vote.
The first time in 100 years, and Jazz, it's only happened 14 times before. So it happened in 1923. It went round after round after round. The other 13 times were all in pre-Civil War America. So this is not something that happens very often. And the Democrats earlier today made a point of saying, look, when we had the gavel 2 years ago, we elected Nancy Pelosi in one round of votes, even though there was a bit of a fracture in the party with members from the furthest left wing of the Democrats, they were still able to coalesce around the leader, and the vote went forward. So Democrats are saying, look, if this is what Republicans are doing with a constitutionally required part of the job, how are they going to be able to govern? And there was one Democrat that said, look, if Republicans can't do it, hand it to the Democrats and we'll simply do it for them.
This is very early, and it may be a bit of an unfair question, but I'm very curious with your thoughts because you cover this so closely. What does this mean for the Republican Party? Let's just say they do eventually vote for someone the 7th, 8th, 10th time, whatever time may be. What does this say about the party itself and its health?
I think that it's going to make things more difficult, or at least it's giving the American public an idea of the party that they put in power. Because, you know, oftentimes this isn't the kind of legislation that we see in the House. And a part of that is because there's no speaker, so there are no rules, so there are more cameras that are allowed inside. This is not, you know, how often we get to see inside the belly of the House of Representatives. But if they're having this kind of a difficulty in doing the constitutionally required part of their job, which is putting a speaker in place to allow for Congress to be sworn in, there are questions being raised as to what is this going to mean when the agenda is laid out, when committees have been assigned, and when investigations are going to be underway. Are we going to run into a situation where Republicans can't, come to any kind of mutual terms with themselves and they're unable to carry forward? This could have a lasting impact. It could also have an impact on the electorate 2 years from now when all of these members of Congress are back up for a vote again. Is this going to be something that the base remembers, and that, well, we put them there and they wasted 3 days trying to just get a leader in place?
The broader public, you talked about the base, but the broader public itself, what's the general sentiment you're getting from them, never mind the base, from them in regards to watching this all unfold?
Well, I mean, look, Democrats and the Democratic base are saying this is precisely what can be expected from a Republican Party that has been fracturing over the last X number of years since Donald Trump really found himself to kind of be splitting the party from the conservatives to the ultra, quote unquote, MAGA parts of the Republican Party. The base is simply saying, look, we need to get things done. And it goes beyond that. I mean, number one, the State Department came out today and said, well, all of this is kind of a bit of nonsensical. It shows the world that this is really what a democratic institution should look like. But on the flip side of that, the kind of broader public is now watching a potential crisis unfold here, because without a Speaker of the House, in the event of a national crisis, security matters become an issue. The Speaker is third in line to the presidency, so there would be no kind of governmental response. So there is, you know, not to say that there's growing worry amongst the broad public, because this is still so early on, but it is something that people are starting to pay attention to.
Reggie, thank you so much for your time, my friend. I know you've had a couple of very long days. It looks like perhaps a few more. Really appreciate you making time for us this evening, Washington time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, we spent a lot of time talking about random vandalism in Vancouver throughout 2022. Well, new year, same problems. Now, a Yale Town business owner is speaking out after his shop suffered two break-ins in two nights, a problem many Vancouver business owners have grown accustomed to. Sean McGarva is the owner of the West of Woodward's Boutique on Hamilton Street. He joins us now. Sean, thanks for speaking to us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks a lot.
Walk me through what the last 24 and 48 hours have been like for you and just your employees and having to deal with this latest B&E.
Yeah, sure. We've definitely had some challenges here coming off the holiday. You know, after being closed for New Year's Day, like most businesses were, had a friend of the Vancouver Fire actually drive by in the early mornings of January 2nd, so about 5 a.m., and notice our glass was broken out. So a tough start to that day and came down to see that there was a break-in. They couldn't fully enter because we do have, like, steel scissor gates, but the glass was definitely broken, and they undressed a mannequin that was within reach in the window, unfortunately. So my father-in-law and I, you know, went to Home Depot and boarded it up ourselves. We weren't able to connect with insurance or anything based on the holiday. So then we were boarded up on that side and conducted business as usual on the second. And overnight on the third, a resident that lives above our store then texted me early morning on the third and said, "Oh my goodness, the other side is broken out." So I rushed down here, and even though we had, you know, moved mannequins away from the other side, the person did return the next morning with a device to reach through the gates even further after the glass was broken out and, you know, steal some more items from a nearby rack. So, yeah, a couple days of deja vu, really, just boarding up the store on both sides now and, you know, dealing with VPD since.
Any idea what it's cost you so far, just in regards to replacement or anything else, what the cost is right now?
Sure. Yeah, I guess, you know, costs are coming through, but I know we're a small store. We've got, you know, really tight traction on all inventory. So we know the items even from surveillance video that were taken. So it's $2,000 total with a winter parka being one and a couple pairs of pants the second night. So, you know, it's not significant overall for our small store. It does. We still feel it for sure. And then, you know, since having, I bought the material and did it myself the first time, the second time had to get a crew out because I was on my own on the third to board up the side. So, you know, that's $1,000 there. And the quote for glass is going to be, you know, like $2,500. So it's getting close to, you know, $4,000 or $5,000. We already spent about $5,000 in steel gates on the inside of all of our windows and the doorway to prevent any entry. But it seems that they're still willing to break through the glass and reach through for a single item. So it's adding up for a small business, of course, you know.
How long have you been in the neighborhood?
We opened, ironically, March of 2020. So in a couple months here, it's going to be our 3 year. So it's been a few years, and we really have become part of this street and this community of Yale Town for sure.
Mm-hmm. And have you noticed, I mean, you've had to go through a lot with COVID and everything else in regards to the timeline that where you've been open. In regards to the street, the neighborhood, have you seen, is it different even in those 3 years or is it the same? Or have you seen some sort of decline in and around where the business is?
Well, I'd say, I can't say visibly an increase in police presence, which I'm also on the Yale Town Business Association board. So I know some efforts that are put in place for awareness and presence. It's not visibly there yet. I know VPD is doing the best they can, and I got to experience it firsthand the past 48 hours, but it's got to be a challenge for them because I can see it on their faces and they're telling me how prevalent this is everywhere in the city, not just Yale Town. So it's definitely, it's a collective effort with residents, shop owners, and obviously law.
Mm-hmm. What do you think needs to happen here? You know, when you hear these stories, they come and go, but you have to deal with it directly, the financial impact, the worry at night, knowing, you know, worrying that somebody doesn't break in tonight in your store. What do you want to see as a business owner and as a citizen here in Vancouver?
I'm all for, I think, improvement of presence. I think they, you know, the police need our support, as well as the investment in helping, you know, circulate and be on the streets in the hours that this kind of mischief's going down. Outside of that, I think, you know, during business hours, it's really just getting back and supporting your local merchants, like really, you know, supporting in your region and taking in a vested interest in the small businesses that are kind of keeping the streets somewhat occupied and present. And because we can't afford to have us go away as small business owners, because we're that fabric of the community that keeps it keeps more eyes and more presence.
Do you worry, though, that there are businesses that are going to close and say, look, whether it's rent or whether it's crime and petty crime, that you're going to lose a lot of the Front Street business, small businesses that are there?
Do I do have that worry, of course. So I think, you know, I'm part of the group that's existing now that's trying to keep that social part of our streets for sure, and having interactive commerce, you know, available. So it's a worry for sure, but with the interaction every day, you can see more and more people wanting to help their community. I think that helps, of course, along with like police presence for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you well, and I really hope you don't have to deal with this anymore, because it's stressful enough when you got to do it two nights in a row. And we wish you the best. Thank you so much for your time and sharing your story today.
Absolutely. Thanks for hearing me out. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple or Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can always listen to the Jazz Joe Hall Show live Monday to Friday from 3 to 6 p.m. on 980 CKNW and connect with me on Twitter at Jazz Joe Hall BC. Talk to you next time.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.